KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
El Cerrito.
From Oakland.
From Albany, California.
Coming up, as a winter shelter prepares to close for the season, 90 homeless residents of Berkeley return to the streets.
I'm here. So when this closes, I'm already looking ahead for the next place, but everything right now is full.
Then a nonprofit wants to help the whole city of San Francisco explore the big questions of life and death.
The lengths that people would go to stay alive, and what is it about life that makes it so special that you would want to and choose to fight to endure?
And we'll hear what inspires some volunteers who care for the dying.
We took a lot of care to collect all of these things he had in his little SRO, and then we cataloged them all when we got back to the ward.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. When winter comes, Bay Area cities open temporary shelters to keep unhoused residents warm and dry. But as winter comes to an end, those shelters close down. In Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, about 500 homeless people will be back in the streets. Dorothy Day in Berkeley is one of these shelters. It's set to close for the year this Sunday. KALW's Liza Veal went to find out what that means for the people that have come to depend on it.
It's raining outside Dorothy Day, just west of downtown Berkeley. Nearly 100 people crowd under an overhang to keep dry until the shelter opens up for the evening. A man named Kermit Camel holds an umbrella for himself and his wife, Gloria. They're from the Midwest and have very Midwestern, kind things to say about the shelter.
The staff been pretty nice, but they can't do too much for us. They have to put us out during the day. So.
And they let me be with my wife all the time.
That's good.
We won't be separated.
Yeah, we won't be separated.
You know, like,
but we don't have privacy, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Gloria and Kermit have been staying at the shelter all winter, almost the entire time they've been homeless, since they lost their place 4 months ago.
I have a job as a personal care assistant, and he works as a grocery clerk.
She says it's hard with those wages to afford a spot in the East Bay, where rents have risen 40 to 50% since 2012. They've been looking.
But every time we try to find somewhere to stay, it's going pretty good, but the deposit is so high.
They don't have plans for this Sunday when the shelter closes down.
I don't know.
Probably we'll be out on the street, she says. The same is likely true for the other 90 guests that sleep here, most of whom were the same regulars all winter. Sean O'Connor also stayed at Dorothy Day most nights this winter. I met him nearby at a free breakfast kitchen where he volunteers.
Cleaning trays, mopping floors, cleaning counters. Yeah, I just kind of like something to fill my time.
He's worried about the shelter closing, although it sounds like mostly for everyone else's sake, rather than his own.
A lot of people are going to be on the streets and sleep in a doorway or, you know, in front of some business.
In cities across the country, thousands of people who spent the winter indoors will be turned out to the street right around the same time. David Stegman is the executive director of Dorothy Day. He says this particular shelter takes care of nearly a tenth of Berkeley's unhoused population.
Over here, you have 1,000 people on the street every night. So the emergency shelter, which just holds 90, is a stopgap measure to not only get people off the street, but in this facility, to be able to connect them with bettering their lives.
This year, Dorothy Day was different from an average winter shelter. Because the city owns the building, it's not used for anything else during the day. And that means they can bring in services for the guests during that time.
So this is a kind of a game changer in Dorothy Day's mind.
The Berkeley Free Clinic comes to the shelter to provide basic health care. They serve 2 meals a day. They've got storage. And most importantly, they bring in agencies that connect people to permanent housing. Just yesterday, 3 people got into housing after working with the service providers at Dorothy Day all winter. But the staff worry that when the shelter closes, a lot of the guests they've been working with will go back to square one, out of touch until next winter, if ever. The progress they made could be lost. Bob Whelan, who manages the shelter, has one particular man on his mind.
You know, they're working on getting housing, but he was with us last year. He got moved up on the list, and then he got lost, and now he's back.
Which raises the question, why can't Dorothy Day and other winter shelters stay open all year round?
We would give anything to be able to keep that place open longer, but we've got limited funding.
Jacqueline McCormick is senior advisor to Berkeley Mayor Aragin. She says the space costs about $20,000 a month, which breaks down to about $30 per person per night. The city is developing a new navigation center, like a shelter with more services. It's also building new permanent supportive housing. In fact, that's the plan for the Dorothy Day building, eventually to turn it into affordable housing.
So there's just too many needs out there.
McCormick says she's as frustrated as anyone with the city's powerlessness in the face of the homelessness crisis. Alameda County's homeless population grew by 39% from 2015 to 2017. Meanwhile, federal funding has shrunk 80% over the last 30 years. So localities are struggling to find new sources of revenue.
We're doing all that we can to fill potholes, and we're doing the best we can with this, you know, with the little bit we had.
She worries the homelessness crisis will become intractable as long as cities are tasked with solving it on their own.
You know, you get to a point where it just, if you don't start tapping it right now, you're never going to be able to address it because it's just getting too big.
A few days later, the week before the shelter is set to close, the staff scrambles to let everyone in an hour early to get out of the rain. I ask manager Bob Whelan if there's any chance they won't have to close on April 15th. Last year, an anonymous private donor put up the money to keep it open an extra 2 months.
Any inkling of hope that they'll be able to keep this open, or is it?
I always have an inkling, but it's diminishing.
Yeah.
Check with me on the 11th.
Yeah. Okay, I will.
Outside the door, Tonette, who works security, jokes around with the guests in line.
Come on, Faye. Come again. I bought some movies for y'all today. Okay.
She's excited about someone who she just helped get connected with housing.
That young man thanking me right there across the street. He graduating from that place, and he going to get a place.
It's a permanent. Nice.
Yes.
So I'm glad you made
it. I tried, you know.
That's not even your job, though, is it? You're just security?
Yeah.
I'm not just security. I'm sorry about that. Okay.
Inside Dorothy Day, people start lying down on mats, charging their phones, getting coffee. Shelters aren't a solution, certainly not a better one than the kind of permanent housing they'll soon build in this space. But they make a world of difference. A man who introduced himself as Hector tells me what it'll mean to be back sleeping on the streets.
I mean, when you think about it, the more that you're out there, the more you have negative contact with neighbors, with police. You know, you're homeless, you're living on the street, so wherever you decide to lay, you know, it's got to be somewhere where nobody's going to bother you, nobody's going to harass you, where you're not trespassing, where the cops don't feel like, well, you should be off the streets and in a shelter somewhere. And there's a whole list of other people. We're the fortunate ones who are inside.
Since he arrived at Dorothy Day, Hector's been working with city staff to get into housing. He says there are a lot of applications. You have to qualify for this in order to get that, and you can't get that until you qualify for this.
I've been looking for housing for over 7 years, and I've applied for every low-income housing, every Section 8 list, every waiting list, and I don't fit in the criteria.
Ultimately, it just comes down to the permanent housing spots are so scarce, the city has to prioritize people who are oldest and in the most dire need.
So I'm here. So when this closes, I'm like everybody else. We're looking, you know, and I'm already looking ahead, you know, for the next place. But everything right now is full. So
what are you thinking it's going to be?
Hurry up and wait. Back to the streets.
As I weave between people's mats on the floor on my way to leave the shelter, someone asks when my radio story will air. I tell him April 12th. It's too late, he says.
You should have ran it like last month.
He's right. It's probably too late. But even last month, it would have been too late. For a lot of people who are homeless right now, the city and state and country are all too late. In Berkeley, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents. Liza is our housing and homelessness reporter. You can reach her at housing@klw.org.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. All next week, all over San Francisco, people will be gathering to talk about something that many find hard to face: death. The local nonprofit Reimagine is partnering with the City of San Francisco and many other organizations to put on a week of activities called Reimagine End of Life. Its aim is to create a citywide community conversation exploring big questions about life and death. There are 175 events planned over the week, from lectures to community discussions to religious worship gatherings. Art is also a big part of the week, including an immersive performance experience called Second Chance. It uses virtual reality, theater, acrobatics, and live music to answer the question, what if facing our death allowed us to live more fully? KALW's Jen Sheehan spoke with founder and executive director of Reimagine, Brad Wolf, and co-producer of Second Chance, Scott Shigioka, about bringing these difficult subjects to light. And a quick note to listeners, KALW is a media sponsor for Reimagine End of Life.
Now, I don't want to make any assumptions about either of you, but you both look like you're on the younger end of the life spectrum normally, or one might think that thinking about end of life is something for those in the older side. I'm wondering what your personal interest or how you came to this topic. How did it come to you?
I come to this topic really through the lens initially of my grandparents, who were both on my dad's side, who were Auschwitz survivors. And, you know, my grandma was able to stay alive because there was actually a Nazi guard who would give her sneak her a sandwich that then she would divide up into little pieces that she would then redistribute to her campmates. So she would get a little bite of a sandwich every day, and that kept her alive. And my grandfather, he survived by taking the food inside of the clothing of the bodies that he had to carry to and from the crematorium. That was his job, is to carry the bodies, and that's how he was able to live. That and eating snails that he would find. And so just growing up and hearing these stories of the lengths that people would go to stay alive, and what is it about life that makes it so special that you would want to and choose to fight to endure all of that suffering, is what got me thinking about the idea of mortality. And then when I was in my 20s, I had one of my best friends, she was diagnosed with a rare form of pediatric cancer. And while she was dying, I'm a songwriter and would bring my guitar to the hospital and started playing music for her. And it was there that I really saw, they talk about the power of music or the power of art, which is something we talk about, but I really felt it when I saw the way that music could impact somebody's experience, hers and mine, over that period.
Yeah, I think, death happens at every age, and it impacts people, whether you're the person that's going through that experience or whether it's a loved one that's going through it. And through my personal life, I've experienced a lot of it and sometimes felt like I didn't have the tools or the community to really talk about it, and really didn't have the tools to be there for those that were going through the process of dying. And over time, learned about ways to support those who are going through that process, and things as simple as, holding someone's hand or being in the room and cultivating a space of silence, or thinking about ways in which you can just be and support someone going through a process like dying, which is really hard. And so I'm really connected to the topic. And I think a lot of people are afraid or fearful of it. And I think any way that we can allow people to open up about it and be vulnerable and be guided in that process is really powerful.
There are so many activities planned during this week, from practical stuff like workshops on advanced care directives to film screenings and lectures and arts activities. How did you decide what to put into the event? How did you curate all the different things?
Yeah, so we see our job at Reimagine as really trying to represent all the ways that this topic reflects back on life itself. So as broad as life is, we want the week to reflect all of that. So, you know, grief isn't something, for example, that's just a sad thing. There's like humor in loss. There's comedy shows. We have like Chris Garcia from Comedy Central coming. We have a show at the Punchline. So there's comedy, but there's also music. There's a lot of musical events, and there's, like you're mentioning, different lectures, but we and you know, events at religious places of worship all across the city. And then there's also these immersive art experiences, for example, that Scott's doing such an incredible job of curating.
Yeah, let's talk about this. Second Chance, an immersive death experience. And when I got this press release in my inbox, I was like, I better open this. What is this? Mm. So can you talk about what that title means? What is the immersive experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, we've been interviewing a bunch of individuals that have experienced death and then were resuscitated and brought back to life. And one of the interesting things that came out from those conversations is that for many of them, it really shaped the way that they orient around time and the way that they orient their lives. And some of them made dramatic changes after that happened around their lifestyle, around passion and purpose, around love and relationships. And it's this powerful tool and a powerful experience that really helps people reflect on their own life and think about, are there changes that I need to make to live out a truly full and rich life? And so, you know, one of the things that we really want to do with Second Chance is to create a really safe and guided space for people to experience that and to be faced with death and their own death in hopes of thinking about those questions and shifting those perspectives. And so the way that it's run is that the experience is guided by end-of-life doulas. There are different conversations that you have with those that are in your group who are strangers. So you're invited to go through the experience with only those you don't know.
And they're strangers, but it's a small group.
Yeah, it's a small, intimate group of 10. Yeah, so 10 individuals are invited into the experience every 30 minutes. And, you know, there's all these different moments. So, for instance, we're brewing a tea, and they're in these beautiful cups by Justin Crow, who's an artist, that are glazed with cremated ashes of loved ones. And that has the tea that will give you the strength and courage to go through these final moments. And we're working with Dream Logic, which is an amazing local group that does virtual reality films, and participants will be experiencing their transition through VR. And throughout the entire process, we wanted to make sure that it was guided, that this isn't a horror experience. This is really about being safe. And that's why we have, you know, on-site counselors, for instance, in private rooms, in case anyone is experiencing something that is difficult for them and they want to talk to someone or just be with someone. But it really, you know, without giving too much away about the experience, it really ends with you being given a second chance at life and to think about how you might do it differently, if at all, the next time around.
I have a question for both of you. Why do you think that U.S. American culture has such a problem with looking death squarely in the eyes versus other cultures that seem to have a more of a grasp on it?
I mean, I would say there's a couple factors. I think our modern culture is really facilitating the taboos that have emerged around this topic. Maybe, you know, in the past, if people grew up in religious households, you were exposed to conversations and rituals related to the end of life. You also lived, in many cases, with your loved ones all the way till the end of their life. Now, in so many cases, our elders live somewhere else, maybe in a different geographic region, perhaps. So we're not with them. End of life has also been medicalized. So people are in hospitals kind of out of sight, out of mind. So, you know, I think there's what we're doing here, and the outpouring of energy around this topic, I think stems from the fact that there's a reaction, an equal and opposite reaction to what is happening, and a need and a desire to connect around these meaningful moments and have them owned instead of through the medical system, have them owned by the community.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of fear around death. One of the fears we hear a lot is the fear of disappearing, the fear of, does my life mean anything, and will anyone remember me, and what did I actually provide in my life? And I think it's so important for us to think about our legacies and to think about what we're passing down to our children, our grandchildren, or those that come after us. And, you know, I think the more that we can step into that really brave space of talking about things that really scare us and that we have fears around, and saying that's okay, that's human, and it's okay to have these fears, and there is a lot of things that we don't know. But if we can talk about it and hold space for each other, then that's a really beautiful thing.
the goal really is to, A, connect the entire city to itself through one universal topic that everyone has to face but we don't often talk about. And then really it's to get people more comfortable thinking about and talking about the topic of end of life with their loved ones, because often we wait till people are already sick or dying before we start broaching this topic. And at that point, it becomes an emergency, it becomes challenging, and instead of focusing on your loved ones, you're instead focusing on the logistics of this. And then finally, I think what I'm passionate about is the way that thinking about mortality and just recognizing it can help remind you to live your life more fully while you have the opportunity. So we're hoping that through this week of celebration of life and an exploration of death, that people leave feeling more alive.
That was Brad Wolf of nonprofit Reimagine and Scott Shigioka, co-producer of Second Chance. They spoke with KLW's Jen Chien. For more information about Reimagine End of Life and the immersive participatory death experience Second Chance, go to klw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Death is difficult for a lot of people to confront, but what if doing so was your job? Tracy Grubb says she grew up fascinated by death. She was afraid, but also curious. That led her to volunteer at the Zen Hospice Project, a San Francisco center for the dying supported by the Buddhist community. This next piece is taken from an interview recorded back in 2016 by StoryCorps as part of an effort to document the experiences of volunteers, patients, and workers at Zen Hospice. Grubbs spoke with her colleague, Lisa Massano.
I can remember very clearly the night that I learned that everybody dies. I think it was like 3 or 4 years old. And my parents were in my room. And, you know, I would say, well, do you mean you're going to die? And so I've always been afraid of it. And I've been always curious about it. So when I heard that there was something like the Zen Hospice Project and they would train you to be with people who were dying, I was very intrigued. And also, I had a growing Buddhist practice at that time, and I wanted to find some way to apply it. But I was also afraid. It took me a while to apply. I remember I downloaded the application, and I kind of had it for about 2 or 3 years before I sent it in. What's required for me to do it is to relax, and that means to allow the person that I'm sitting with to be themselves, and for me to really show up and be myself, too.
That makes me think of a recent resident, Pietro, that you got to know a little bit and spent some time with.
I spent time with him because I helped him clear out of his apartment in North Beach. We took a lot of care to collect all of these things he had in his little SRO, and then we cataloged them all. When we got back to the ward, you know, there was a certain number of suits that all had been tailored, he was pointing out the Italian suits. And when he died about a week later, you know, I was sitting in the room with his body, and the staff just came in and put everything in garbage bags and, you know, put it in the storage room for him, for whoever was going to claim it. But there wasn't anyone. I mean, it was just, they were just things then. The other thing from Pietro, and this is not something that I witnessed, but Teresa, our shiftmate, said, is that before he died, he was very restless in bed and at one point sat right up and looked at her. She was just sitting there to be with him. And he said to her to remember that it's all about love and don't get sidetracked, he told her. Don't get sidetracked. Such great, amazing words from him that I've since shared with other residents on the floor who knew him, including Alfredo, his Italian compatriot, because Alfredo keeps saying, well, what do you think he means by, you know, love is the most important thing. And what did he mean by not get sidetracked? You know, so I love also that the spirit of Pietro is still very much in the room when I'm meeting with Alfredo, and he's very much in me, you know, as I continue to think about how to serve on the ward in the best way I can.
That was Tracy Grubb speaking with Lisa Misano back in 2016. Their conversation was recorded by San Francisco StoryCorps and produced by KALW's Rachel Vasquez for the Spiritual Edge Project. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Nina Gensler-Debs, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Marisol Medina-Cadena, Bo Walsh, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rowland, Jackie Sajiko, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Sour Widows. This duo from Albany play the Hemlock Tavern on Saturday. Show starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Graven the blood.